It gives me great pleasure to introduce Professor Richard Griffith this evening, who's going to lecture on profits in our own country, entrepreneurial activity in the Lower Rhondda. Richard was educated at Lancing, King's College, Cambridge, fellowship at Selman Brasenose, ended up as a chair in French at Cardiff, and then at King's College, London, where he was the chair of French literature, French history, French language, all French, I think. So there we go. That's very good. So a distinguished professor this evening. Just a few words of introduction. Industry and the entrepreneurs that created modern worlds are a subject which I think has been much neglected in the history of Wales. Indeed, I think there is a danger of developing an edifice of social and political history without the foundation of economic and particularly industrial history. Certainly, the result of this neglect has been a serious lack of congruence between the historical scholarship of Wales and its industrial development. This assertion can be quantified. Of just over 1,000 theses on Welsh history between 1970 and 1995, only 63% were industrial, which is extraordinary lack of congruence. This could have and does have curious effects on the collective memory of Wales. The pedigree of neglect is as long and as lengthy as the neglect. If you go back to 1845, the schools of design were established in London, and there were 545 students in Glasgow alone, pattern makers, tool makers, draftsmen, all sorts of people. And in London, it was actually housed, it was so prestigious, it was housed in Somerset House. In Wales, there were none. Nothing. It was noted by all sorts of people, including Lloyd George, who gave a speech on it at Cardiff in around 1900. And it was not as if Wales was poor at engineering. The steel companies in Monmouthshire, just them alone, employed over 1,000 highly skilled engineers. The steel industry, as you know, is a chemical and engineering industry. That's what it is. And they employed 1,000 engineers. The problem was the translation of those engineers into entrepreneurs. It never happened. The problem continues with comparatively very low startups in Wales, though curiously in England, Welshmen seem rather good at being entrepreneurs. From just my small village and the surrounds, Newbridge in the Ebro Valley, there are one billionaire and three multimillionaires recently in electronics and so on. So whether it's to do with Wales, I don't know, and the culture, I don't know. All this background, I think, underlines the importance and the topicality of this talk. Richard has come to this subject from a different field, and I think then with a fresh eye. So, Richard.
Well, thank you very much. I became aware the moment I returned to Wales in my retirement about how neglected this aspect of Welsh industrial history had been. My approach to it has been slightly different from what has just been mentioned because I'm particularly interested in the social history of the entrepreneurs, and I shall be pointing out during the talk just how many Welsh entrepreneurs there were in the 19th century. So there's a slight sort of difference of approach. But I realise that apart from Professor Elliott and just one or two others, almost nothing had been written upon the middle classes of South Wales in the 19th century. Almost everything that has been written about that society, the society of the coal boom, has been about the workers and the unions. So I set about trying to see how these people actually lived. The people, not just the coal owners, but all the people, all the many other entrepreneurs who made money and flourished on the opportunities provided by the coal trade. I'll try as far as possible in this short talk to give you the essence of my findings on this social life, by looking in detail at a series of individual cases, which is all I can really do in 40 minutes. I'd like to start with a party which took place in 1888. Of all places, this party took place in a Welsh Congregationalist chapel. Saron Chapel in Ynysheer, a small mining community a mile or two north of Porth in the Rhondda-Vach Valley. The host was James Thomas, commonly known as Shamps Thomas, the veteran coal owner whose standard collieries lay just below the chapel, and who owned other collieries in the Rhondda, including Tynewydd and Troyderew in Porth and Ynysfio near Treherbert. The occasion was the coming of age of his grandson, Willie, who since the unexpected death of Shamps's son 3 years earlier had become the old man's sole heir. The chapel was packed with a variety of people. There were representatives of the workmen who'd contributed to a collection which had provided a library of over 200 books and a suite of magnificent furniture for the young man. Then there were a whole assembly of local middle-class worthies from the Porth and Pontypridd area, among whom one can distinguish various successful contractors, both railway and civil. And then there were the landowners, on whom the coal industry had so significantly relied. These included Idris Williams of Porth, whose family had been simple farmers who'd owned Porth Farm, on which the township of Porth had been built. And the wife and nephew of the Reverend David Watkin Williams, of whom more anon, who owned the land on which Shamps's standard collieries had been sunk. Watkin Williams himself was unable to attend, but his nephew was one of the principal speakers at the event, as was Idris Williams, the other landowner present. A representative of the workmen also spoke. But the main speaker and the guest of honour was, however, someone who, to our eyes, is a very unexpected figure to have been there at all. It was William Abraham, the famous miners' leader, always known as Mabon, who 3 years earlier had been elected as Lib-Lab MP for the Rhondda seat. Mabon delivered a panegyric of praise for Shamps Thomas. He drew attention to the fact that he himself and Shamps had both come from the same kind of humble background. He marvelled at the fact that without the aid of books or learning, Shamps had, as he said, been able to attain a very high and most honourable position through his intelligence and perseverance. It has to be said that Shamps himself was still semi-illiterate and also found great difficulty in expressing himself in English. His attaining this high position had been the means, said Mabon, of helping others to attain a good position in life. Mabon then praised Willie, the young man in whose honour the party was being held, and pointed to the good stock, as he said, from which he sprung. This account of this party is significant for a number of reasons. Firstly, though the newspaper report was in English, most of the proceedings, if not all, had taken place in Welsh. Secondly, it took place in a nonconformist chapel. This was a Welsh society in which workers and employers, landowners and entrepreneurs shared a common culture and a common language and mostly worshipped in the same chapels. The fluid nature of the class structure of this society is shown not only by the humble origins of the milieu co-owner, Shamps, who'd started as a doorboy down the mine at the age of 6, but also by the fact that workers and employers were often from the same families. The miner who'd collected the money from the other workers for the coming-of-age gift turns out to have been Moses Powell, a brother-in-law of Shamps' son. And it's worth noting that at the time of the terrible disaster at Shamps' Tynewydd mine in 1877, among the 7 trapped coal-faced colliers who were eventually rescued had been not only Moses Powell, but also an actual nephew of Shamps's, George Jenkins, son of his sister Anne. Shamps often employed relatives in his mines, but they could expect no favours from him. Some who had exceptional qualities, like his nephew John, who became manager of the Standard Collieries, and his brother Zephaniah, who managed the Tynewydd mine, were given management roles. Others just became straightforward colliers. And he certainly believed that everyone should experience work at the coalface if they were in the mines. Part of the education of his grandson and heir, Willie, who is in fact the future Sir William James Thomas, part of Willie's education had been to work as a collier down the mine, as was pointed out with approval by one of the workers' representatives at the party. It has to be admitted that this is a picture that by the late 1880s was already changing, as we shall see. But two of the important features of this picture, social mobility and Welshness, are typical of the early phases of the coal boom, which started in the 1840s. The mineral industries which had flourished in South Wales from the 18th century onwards, the ironworks at the heads of the valleys and the copper industry in the Swansea area, had almost entirely been run by Englishmen. Yorkshiremen like the Crawshays of Merthyr, men from Cornwall like the Vivians of Swansea, and so on. The outlay required to set up in the iron and steel industry meant that these entrepreneurs needed a great deal of money behind them, money which they and their families had usually gained elsewhere. But the early stages of the coal boom consisted mainly of small mines producing bituminous coal, which went down to no great depth compared with the deep mines later developed to reach the seams of steam coal. To sink a mine was therefore within the reach, financially, of people with modest means. And within the South Wales valleys, there were already a large number of people who'd made money in the ancillary activities in the towns that had grown up around the iron trade. Shopkeepers, solicitors, contractors, and so on. It's fascinating to see the backgrounds from which so many of the early coal owners came. Samuel Thomas Usquebaugh Wen, the father of the future Lord Rhondda, who made his fortune in the Aberdare Valley and then in Clydach Vale, was a Merthyr grocer. John Lewis of the Troy Deroux Company in Porth was an Aberdare grocer. David Davis, A-V-I-S, not the David Davis Landon. David Davis, though, of the great family founder of the prosperous Ferndale collieries in the Rhondda Vach, was an Aberdare draper, and so on. Often these people felt the need for a mining expert to go into partnership with them, and it was through this that men like Shamps Thomas or David Williams Annis Cunnan, who'd worked their way up from the ranks, found their opportunities and themselves became some of the most successful coal owners. Others came to coal owning through already having made their money in another entrepreneurial activity connected with the industry. For example, railway contracting in the case of men like David Davis, Ocean Collieries, or William Henry Matthias of Albion Colliery. The vast majority of these coal entrepreneurs were therefore Welsh, though there were in fact a small number of prominent exceptions to this. For example, the Scotsman Archibald Hood, or North countrymen like John Nixon, Edmund Watts, and John Calvert. Though coal earning was the major industry which dominated the valleys, there were many other means dependent on that industry through which people could make fortunes. There were, of course, the landowners whose property was used for mining and who made fortunes through leases and royalties. Though much of the land was owned by absentee landlords such as the Marquess of Bute and Lord Dunraven, there were also a good number of small landowners, including farmers who owned their own land. In due course, some of these simple farmers became part of the new aristocracy of money which dominated the valleys. Typical of these were the Williams family of Porth Farm, of whom we've already seen Idris Williams at the party, the Morgan family of Tinner Cummer Farm, Cummer on the other side of the river at Porth, and William Morgan of Tynewydd Farm, Treherbert. The lives of such people became completely changed. An extreme example is the Reverend David Watkin Williams, one of the characters of the valleys. He'd for several years been perpetual curate of the parish of Ystrad y Fodwng, which is the Rhondda parish. Until in 1857, his father, who owned extensive land in the Rhondda Valleys, had died, leaving it all to him. Within 18 months, David had relinquished his living, and as the Western Mail later put it, he abandoned his clerical duties so far as not to associate himself with the constant practice of his profession. Throughout the rest of his life, he joined to his sacred character the habits of a country squire. He rode to hounds and in every way lived the life of a country gent. And there were those who, having made their money in other spheres, then bought land in crucial positions in the valleys. Many of these people, as well as gaining mineral royalties, also became property developers on the land they'd bought, building housing for the workers who'd come streaming into the valleys. Now, all this house building and the ancillary development of public services, together with the rapid development of the many railways in the area, provided another great opportunity for rich pickings. Particularly for those who possessed the basic skills required and who had an entrepreneurial flair. Many came to the valleys from West Wales, where they'd been working in a small way as builders or as farmers. Two examples, Richard Matthias and Charles Jenkins, will show the trend. Richard Matthias came of a family of builders in rural Carmarthenshire. His father moved to Tenby at the beginning of the 19th century to take advantage of the building boom that accompanied the development of that town as a fashionable resort. And in his turn, seeing southeast Wales as the new bonanza, his son Richard moved there in the 1840s, becoming a major contractor for the Taffdale Railway Company and at the same time a flourishing civil contractor in the townships. My other example, Charles Jenkins, came to Glamorgan from Cardiganshire, where his family were small farmers. The upward curve of his fortunes was swift. Between 1851 and 1861, he was working as a carpenter in Aberdare. By 1871, he'd become a timber merchant in Porth. And by 1881, the census tells us, he was a timber merchant and contractor employing about 80 men. Eventually, under his son David, the firm Charles Jenkins and Son came to hold a preeminent position among Rhondda contractors. And there were also the many shopkeepers who flocked to the valleys from far and wide, but often too from West Wales. They came to the shopping centres in hub towns such as Porth, where Hannah Street shops were known throughout the valleys. Fortunes were made by many kinds of shopkeeper, but above all by grocers and provision merchants. Preeminent among these was William Evans, who came to Porth in 1883 at the age of 19, and 2 years later had founded the famous Thomas and Evans store in Hannah Street. It was he who developed the well-known Corona brand of mineral waters, which were sold throughout the United Kingdom, and with Thomas and Evans also opening many branches throughout South Wales. Evans, a millionaire, continued to live in Porth and was a great local benefactor. Though he was exceptional, many lesser fortunes, as we shall see, were made by prosperous grocers and other shopkeepers throughout the valleys. Now, the new rich of the Porth area, like similar people in other townships in the Rhondda, built for themselves great mansions which fitted their new status, usually on the lower slopes of the hillsides above the valleys. Thus, Idris Williams of Porth Farm built himself an imposing house called Bryn Glas on the slopes above Porth to the east. And the Morgan family of Tinner Cummer Farm built a mansion called Tinner Cummer Hall on the lower slopes of Cummer Hill, which was later lived in by the railway contractor and co-owner William Henry Matthias. The co-owners, Shapps Thomas of Standard Collieries and Thomas Jones of Unishere Colliery, both lived in grand houses overlooking their mines, Brynowell and Mindy Hall. And Thomas Griffiths of Cummer Collieries lived in a similar house in Cummer called Maes Gwyn. William Evans of Thomas and Evans had the grandest estate of all, a magnificent house and park called Bronwith that she eventually left to the municipality. These pioneers, in their various walks of life, had often walked alone, preoccupied with their individual careers. Their horizons had usually been restricted to their families and a number of close friends. In the second generation, however, of their children, a coherent middle-class society emerged, sharing the same interests as each other and collaborating in various speculative ventures. They built on the fortunes made by their fathers, but in some respects their activities were less productive and more speculative. The previous generation had, of course, been similarly driven by the acquisition of wealth, but added to this there was now a thirst for position and for the outward trappings of success. Though many of this new generation shared the abilities of their fathers, their activities were less governed by those skills than by the new skills of networking, which enabled them to manipulate things to their own advantage through such things as insider knowledge and the judicious use of contacts and reciprocal help. I think it'll be worth homing in on these people, examining this change of approach by looking at the specific community concentrated around the towns of Porth and Pontypridd, and in particular a small number of families, often children of the pioneers, who were at the core of that community. In particular, I'll be looking at Shamps Thomas's three sons-in-law, William Henry Matthias, railway contractor and coal owner, David Jenkins, the contractor son of Charles Jenkins, who I've already mentioned, and Richard Packer, accountant and company secretary. Then there's Thomas Griffiths, manager of Cymer Collieries and one of the foremost figures in the South Wales mining industry. Arthur and Edward Williams, both solicitors, respectively the son and the nephew of Idris Williams, Porth Farm. Walter Morgan, a Pontypridd solicitor, son of the Treherbert farmer landowner William Morgan. Daniel and Edmund Thomas, both local coal owners and sons of the veteran coal owner Daniel Thomas Sr. And Walter Nicholas, the Pontypridd solicitor who became one of the leading figures in South Wales local government, and so on. From the local newspapers, I find that much of the social activity of this group took place in and around the nonconformist chapels. Idris Williams, for example, was a pillar of Porth Welsh Congregationalist Chapel, who's been described as one of the most influential nonconformist laymen in South Wales. The same chapel was frequented by William Henry Matthias, David Jenkins, and their families. Cymer Welsh Congregationalist Chapel, just up the hill on the other side of the river, had as prominent members of the congregation Thomas Griffiths, Cymer Collieries, Edmund Thomas, Llyn Celyn Colliery, Daniel Thomas, Brithwip Wyneth Colliery, and Richard Packer, the accountant, who was company secretary by now of Shamps Thomas's Standard Collieries. Edmund Thomas, in fact, gave the address there in 1877 at the service celebrating the rescue of the trapped men at the Tynewydd disaster, in which he himself had played a significant part. The congregation on that day in that chapel was over 1,500 people, consisting mainly of miners and their families. And in both these chapels, of course, and in Sara, on the chapel of the Thomas family in Anorisia, the services were naturally all conducted in Welsh. The social interface between these various clans went far beyond the chapel, however. There was some intermarriage. A lot of them married each other's the sons and daughters of neighbouring entrepreneurs. And as the second generation became more firmly ensconced in their social position, many opportunities for networking arose. This networking was facilitated by the various power bases which had by now had emerged. The local bench of magistrates, for example, included among the JPs William Morgan Tynewydd, William Henry Matthias, Theophilus Hamlin Williams, the heir of the Reverend David Williams, Thomas Jones of the Anorisia mine, and a number of others. The emerging structures of local government, too, played their part. On the Ystrad y Fodog local board, which eventually became the Rhondda Urban District Council, Thomas Griffiths of the Cymer Collieries and William Henry Matthias formed a formidable partnership and wielded great influence. This power base was aided by the fact that the clerks of the council were successively Matthias's two close friends, the solicitors Walter Morgan and Walter Nicholas. An extension of this power from 1889 onwards was to be found in the new Glamorgan County Council, where members included Idris Williams, William Henry Matthias, William Morgan Tynoeth, and Morgan's son, the Pontypridd solicitor Walter Morgan, whose name you'll find continually recurs, and who was, as we'll see, a particular collaborator and crony of Matthias. In passing, it's worth noting that the legal profession appears to have been a perfectly natural stepping stone to greater power and influence, as it always has been. On the Ystrad Vodag Board and the Rhondda Urban District Council, what we would regard as the normal rules regarding the declaration of interest, etc., appear to be completely unknown. And indeed, certain people were entrusted with looking after matters precisely because they did have an interest in them and might therefore be presumed to know something about the matters concerned. It's extraordinary to see. Who shall we send? We'll send so-and-so. He's got an interest in it. He knows what it's all about. Similarly, where the bench of managers was concerned, I found something extraordinary. It seems to have been perfectly acceptable for the director of a colliery to sit in judgment on workers against whom his own colliery was attempting to serve summonses. Where there's local networking among the recent entrants to the Company of the Great and the Good worked particularly well, however, was in the creation of new areas for profit. Walter Morgan, who'd found the Pontypridd law firm of Morgan, Bruce and Nicholas, was a prime operator in this area, often collaborating with his friend William Henry Matthias, an equally skilled operator. One could give many examples of their activities, but I think it would be worth going into detail into one venture in particular, which will give a taste of their methods. This was their joint acquisition of a farm called Park Newydd, near Aber Tridwr, in the Aber Valley, in the early 1890s. At first sight, the decision to buy a farm in that almost uninhabited part of the Aber Valley seems a surprising one. However, within a couple of years, Insoles, the major mining company which had developed the Cummer Collieries in Porth, sank a major mine there, the Windsor Colliery, very near to the site of the farm. It's only when we realise that the Insoles engineer entrusted with sinking this colliery was Matthias's close friend and collaborator on the Ystrad Vodag local board, Thomas Griffiths, that we realised that Matthias and Morgan must have had inside information as to the company's intentions, as was the case in other property acquisitions of theirs. In 1892, Insoles took out a 99-year lease on the minerals under Park Newydd Farm, on very advantageous terms for the two owners, a rent of £300 a year and a royalty on all the coal extracted of 1/12 of the average selling price. They'd chosen this farm, however, for another profitable reason. It's often been remarked that land was at times bought in the narrow Welsh valleys specifically because it covered the whole width of the valley and therefore the railway had no way to get through except across your land. When the Marquess of Bute had bought the farm of Cwm Saibron in the upper Rhondda, for example, it had been on the basis of enthusiastic advice he'd been given, and I quote, that the farm extends across the whole valley so that no railway may be taken up without crossing it. The same was true of the farm bought by Morgan and Matthias. When the Rumney Railway Company decided in 1896 to build a line up the Aber Valley to serve not only Windsor Colliery, but also the university collieries of St. Enid at the head of the valley, it was forced to negotiate with Matthias and Morgan, who struck a hard deal, as a letter which I found from the general manager of the railway to the company's solicitors bears witness. "These people have got an enormous amount of company out of the money," he wrote. "In fact, almost as much as the farm cost, and still retaining the minerals under it." The mutual self-help typical of the Valley's entrepreneurs meant that Matthias and Morgan had shared their insider information with Morgan's partner in the Pontypridd solicitor's practice, Gerald Bruce, who, at the same time as their purchase, had bought a neighbouring farm called Gwenamilwr. All three men now set about getting even better value out of their land by developing on it housing estates for the mine workers. For this purpose, Gerald Bruce formed a company called the Gwenamilwr Land Company Limited, of which one of the main subscribers was Matthias's son-in-law, Dr. George Dorking. Both estates were highly successful. This pattern of acquisition had been followed by these same two men in a number of other farms in crucial areas. In particular, a 208-acre farm in Clydach Vale, which they leased from 1889 to the future Lord Rothermere's firm, Thomas Riches and Company. And after Morgan's premature death in 1900, Matthias continued on his own, buying farms in Llanharan, Gilvach, Goch, and other areas, all of which were let for considerable sums to mining companies. And this generation of Rhondda entrepreneurs not only extended its financial interests, as in this case, to the coal mining industry in other valleys, it also moved into entrepreneurial activities in places outside the coalfield and in completely different areas of interest. Thus, William Henry Matthias, for example, became involved with flour milling as the director of Cardiff and Channel Mills in Cardiff. And also, and I find this amazing, set up with his close friend and collaborator, James Herman of the Taff Vale Railway Company, set up a company to build a pier at Weston-super-Mare. Such ventures outside the valleys often used the same techniques that had served so well at home. A prime example was the manoeuvring surrounding the building of the Cowbridge-Aberthaw Railway, which I've dealt with in an article for the Cummeradorian Transactions about 7 years ago. There, the decision by the Taff Vale Railway Company to back this railway, a matter about which it had had considerable reservations up till then, that decision appears to have been taken in 1888 as a result of various crucial TVR representatives being given in that year directorships of a flourishing Rhondda colliery. The window on the world that had now been achieved by the Rhondda entrepreneurs meant that it wasn't such a close-knit circle of acquaintances and collaborators that came into play. It was a far wider variety, containing other entrepreneurs from throughout South Wales. Lascelles Carr of the Western Mail, Daniel Owen of Ashhall, Ystradwyn, the O'Callaghan brothers of Penarth, the Cardiff landowner Charles Williams of Roath Court, and representatives of the Taff Vale Railway Company such as Henry Oakden Fisher and James Herman. In case you think it was all like that, it has to be admitted that though these activities that I've been describing were so widespread, they did not extend to all people of this generation. There were some who continued the straightforward methods of the past. One such example from our Porth Pontypridd area was Sir William James Thomas, the grandson of Old Shamps Thomas, the Willie, whom we saw at his coming-of-age party. Thomas did build on the fortune he'd been left by branching out into new areas of mining. But when he bought land, it was not because of insider knowledge as to other people's intentions, but because of his own personal knowledge as to what he intended to do. As when he bought the land on which he developed the new Bedworth Navigation Colliery and built the township of Thomas, named after himself, to house the workers. Also, unlike so many of the new generation, Thomas did not see himself as a cut above the workers socially. Innumerable accounts, which can't all have been the usual sycophancy, bore witness to the fact the workers saw him as a people's man. And it contrasts with the impression I've got, and people talk about many of the second generation entrepreneurs, that they considered the workers to be almost a race apart. There'd been that gradual move away. But Thomas appears to have tried. In fact, he called himself a workers' man and backed Mabon at the elections and said he was basically a Labour man at heart. And I'm not sure how much I believe it, but nevertheless, there he is doing something quite different. So in a way, Sir William James Thomas seems almost a throwback to the generation of his grandfather. In another way, however, he was typical of another, more admirable trend adopted by a small number of the new generation, philanthropic giving. In his case, hospitals and places of worship were the main recipients of his largesse. He continued to live in the Porth area, in his grandfather's house, Brynawl, in Ynysfyr, but his generosity extended from the local Porth hospital to the Royal Infirmary in Cardiff, where he funded the creation of a William James Thomas ward, and to the new medical school at the university, to which in all he gave the equivalent in modern terms of over £5.5 million. And what of the mining industry, meanwhile? It too had undergone a sea change. The need for steam coal to be extracted from ever deeper mines had meant that the financing of mining ventures had become ever more expensive, so that the old easy access into the business had gone. In place of the old mining pioneers, who often worked at their own mines and had close contacts with the workforce, one now had to have shareholders and limited liability companies, of which the directors mostly came either from Cardiff or from London. There was usually at least one such director who had actual mining experience, but the day-to-day running of the mines was left in the hands of professional managers. And gradually, as the new century dawned, big combines began to take over from the individual owners, starting with what I've always called the Cambrian Combine, but Di Smith tells me it should be the Cambrian Combine, starting with the Cambrian Combine of D.A. Thomas, Lord Rother. There remained little scope for the old-style coal entrepreneurs. As the First World War approached, the valleys and the coal trade on which they were based still appeared as prosperous as ever. There was little sign of the severe recession that was to hit them in the interwar period. Nevertheless, a new phenomenon had already started. The move by so many of the valley's entrepreneurs and their families to the towns on the coast and to the Vale of Glamorgan. Of course, as early as the mid-19th century, coal owners and their heirs had bought and lived in properties in these areas. The same is true also of those who had made their money in other ways, as landowners or tradesmen or builders. Those from the Porth Pontypridd area were no exception. In the twin townships in the Vale of Glamorgan of Cowbridge and Llanblethian, for example, we find substantial properties and farms being bought in the 1880s by the Reverend David Watkin Williams, by the successful Porth grocer William Griffiths, by the Porth hay merchant David Powell, and by the Trealow grocer John Rhys Evans. In the early 20th century, two very substantial properties in Llanblethian, Great House and Crossways, were bought by William Henry Matthias and his nephew William James Thomas. By the immediate pre-war period and the war itself, people were, however, beginning not just to buy extra properties in this way, but themselves to move out of the valleys into such properties once they'd made their money. For many of these, the lure of the coastal towns was particularly attractive. This included coal owners who'd sold out to the combines and who now drew their profits out of the valleys. In 1916, Sir William James Thomas, grandson of Shapps, sold his mining interests and moved to Birchwood Grange, Teguin Road, Penylan. While his cousin, John Thomas, former manager of Standard Collieries, built a house near him alongside Roth Park. William James Thomas's close associate and ally, Lord Pontypridd, who as Alfred Thomas had been Liberal MP for Mid Glamorgan, lived nearby, further along Teguin Road. Other associates of theirs, such as Edmund Hann, moved to Cardiff's leafy suburbs at the same time. Llanishan and later Radder were particularly favoured spots, as was the small seaside township of Penarth. It was not just those who'd been in the coal trade who moved down to the coast of the Vale. Shopkeepers also came, such as Lemuel Griffiths, the Dinas grocer, who retired to Barry in 1907 from the shop he'd inherited from his father when still only in his early 40s, and continued to live there as a gentleman of leisure and a local JP until the Second World War. Similarly, the Adinnes innkeeper, William Rees, bought a Georgian property in Llanblethian and there took up a new life as a dairy farmer. He then sold that property and moved to an attractive Llanblethian villa called The Thorn, which he nostalgically renamed as Rhondda Villa. The Porth hay merchant, David Powell, also converted himself into a farmer, leasing in Cowbridge a farm called Lake Farm, of which his family were to be tenants for over 90 years. The expatriate village people often still tended to stick together. Usually this was facilitated, as always, by the chapels they attended and by certain key figures. In Barry, for example, there was a strong Welsh-speaking middle-class contingent which gathered around the Welsh Congregational Chapel Bethesda in High Street. A key figure who linked everyone together was the Porth grocer Evan Walters, who now had a shop in Gladstone Road and had delivered his goods to people in their houses. And I know that during the war, those who came from Porth had extra rations from the grocer because he too came from Porth. In Cardiff, at a rather higher social level, the Crachach, including Sir William James Thomas and his family, gathered around a congregational church, but in this case an English-speaking one, Roath Park English Congregational Church in Penewine Road, where the minister was the Reverend R.E. Salmon, who in the 1900s had been a popular young pastor in Porth. As an aside, I'd just like to touch for a moment on the phenomenon of gentrification and Englishification, which had taken place in some of the more prominent families. This can in part be traced through the schools to which the children were sent. In many cases, the first generation had been either uneducated or self-educated. The second generation tended to go to Welsh grammar schools or Welsh public schools. By the time of the third generation, English public schools were to the fore, with a preference either for Eton or Harrow, or for nearer schools such as Shrewsbury or Clifton. A good example is the family of David Williams, Enniscannon. David Williams had started down the mines as a working haulier. We're told that by grit, perseverance and a large measure of luck, he worked his way up, making a fortune sinking mines in the Cannon Valley, and then investing extensively in land both in the valleys and in the Vale of Glamorgan. His son, Gwilym Williams, was educated at Cowbridge Grammar School and became a successful barrister and then a judge and a leading figure in Welsh society, and his statue stands outside the law courts in Cardiff. He lived at Miskin Manor near Llantrisant. Gwilym's son, Rhys, later Sir Rhys Williams, was educated at Eton and Oriel College, Oxford. He too became a barrister. Though, like his father, he was still Welsh-speaking, he took on English manners, hosted royalty at Miskin Manor, lived at prestigious London addresses, belonged to fashionable London clubs. He became a lieutenant colonel in the Welsh Guards in the First World War, and afterwards became a coalition Liberal MP. Rhys's son, that's the fourth generation, Sir Brandon Rhys Williams, who some of you may have come across, also Eton and the Welsh Guards, was a prominent Conservative backbencher in the period after the Second World War. So it's an incredible transition. And you see it in so many of the families, and the choice of the schools is so interesting in the individual cases. The great entrepreneur, Mrs. Miles, who came from Pontypridd and who built all these hotels and ran hotels throughout Wales, including the Metropole in Llandrindod Wells. She came from having been a widow running a little pub in Pentre and ended up with this great whole series of hotels, including the Angel in Cardiff and so on. But she sent her children to Harrow. And so it happens. Now, as we've seen, by the end of the First World War, many of our entrepreneurs and their families had moved to the coastal towns of the Vale, taking their accumulated wealth with them. In this way, they escaped the results of the crash of the early 20s. The big companies to which the coal owners had sold out were, in fact, better able to weather the storm than the old individualists could have done. By the late 1920s, South Wales exports had fallen by 23%, and by the mid-1930s, by a further 25%. The main brunt of this recession hit, of course, the workers. In the interwar period, the number of men employed fell from over 271,000 to 112,000. And the grim despair of the region has been captured in many accounts. I don't need to go further into it here. By contrast, the heirs of those who got out of the industry managed to live comfortably. Not for them the entrepreneurial spirit of the late 19th century. Instead, they were for the most part happy to live on the income from the accumulated wealth that had come to them. Some, such as the heirs of the Davises of Llandinham, devoted a good deal of their time to public-spirited activities, chairing public bodies, sponsoring good works of various kinds, and giving generously to charity. At the other end of the spectrum, others lived a life of conspicuous waste and extravagance. Some drank away the proceeds. Others invested cautiously and badly, war loan being a typically popular investment. Mostly, however, the heirs hung on to their money without either generosity or personal extravagance. Some undertook prestigious careers. Others remained in relative obscurity. The affluent Cardiff roads and suburbs contained many wealthy but retiring widows and spinsters. The impression given by many of these was one of decent respectability, but often of lack of any concept of the realities of the industrial society that had nurtured them. When we look back on the South Wales coal boom, it comes as something of a surprise to realise that it lasted for only 80 years, from about 1840 to about 1920. To us living in present-day South Wales, it seems like a monumental past that had always been there. Yet those 80 years of feverish activity came and went within the lifetime of a long-lived individual. We can find a great deal to criticise in the activities and attitudes of the employers of this period. Their lack of concern in many cases for the living conditions of those they employed. Their single-minded pursuit of profit. Their neglect of safety measures if they interfered with production. Their bullying tactics in times of industrial dispute. All these things have caused their reputation to be a very bad one. It's all very well saying in palliation that these were the ways of the time, or that if they'd not initiated the wealth-producing process, most of the workers would have been starving in the dire conditions of 19th century agriculture. It's abundantly clear that in almost every case, profit was their single greatest motive, and all else was subordinated to that. Looking back at what became of the valleys after the First World War, however, I think we can perceive that there's an even greater thing for which these entrepreneurs can be criticised, and that is lack of foresight. Despite the wide variety of activities we've seen, they've created an almost single industry region, with all those activities entirely dependent upon coal. There'd been no thought of what the future might hold once coal profits ceased. They took their wealth out of the region, turning their backs on the population that had made their prosperity. Those people from the Porth Pontypridd area which we've been looking were neither better nor worse than the average of such people. They, like their contemporaries elsewhere in the valleys, unthinkingly followed the attitudes and behaviour of the society of which they were part. As such, I think they've been eminently worthy of study. And finally, I have a confession to make. I myself am a direct descendant of both the bad and the good in that entrepreneurial society. Shamps Thomas was my great-great-grandfather. William Matthias was my great-grandfather. And Lemuel Griffiths, the Porth grocer who retired to Barry, was my grandfather.